This is Felfarin. And I am driving around. It is Thursday. I'm heading to the church for another seminar, worship team seminar. So I'm not actually going home. I'm trying to get out of the Walmart parking lot at the moment because I got myself some food. It's funny. I've been doing this fasting 2 days a week thing as opposed to fasting, kind of in addition, kind of fasting, you know, on the wait to eat one meal a day, wait till 3 o'clock to eat. And several weeks ago, I just got this, I may have mentioned that, I just got this craving for like beef sausage. So I found some vegetarian sausages. They were pretty good. They're pretty good. And so I did that for a while after I'd had beef sausages a couple of times. And that was back in Walmart now getting some food. And I was like, I want a beef sausage. So I got myself some beef sausage. Oh, I don't know. And we are done with the fast for our church now. And I just woke up this week and I thought, well, I suppose I could not do that and just go back to what I was doing, but, you know, it wasn't too bad. And it kind of breaks up the week, because in this schedule, I stop eating Tuesday night, stop eating Sunday night, start eating Tuesday afternoon, like 2 or 3 in the afternoon, then eat Tuesday the rest of the day, and then stop eating Tuesday night and start eating Thursday around 3 o'clock. So, you know, it makes for a couple of 40-hour fasts a week. And it seems to be fine. And supposedly, the less you eat, the longer you live. Within reason. within reason. There's the... At this point, intermittent fasting does seem across the board to increase longevity, no matter what the organism is, anywhere from yeast to monkeys to mice to, you know, so, hey, you know, we'll give it a try. So it's good, all is well. I am not done with the book yet, but I'm close. Last night, I pushed into, well, first of all, over the weekend, normally, on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday run, I put down about 7,500 words. So it's 500, 1,500, 2,500, and 3,000. So that's 7,500 words. I think. Yes, that's 7,500 words. I decided, okay, you've got to tack in. You've got to get this book finished. So last Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I put down 15,000 words. I put down double that. And I still didn't finish the book. But I was close. I got closer Monday night. But I had to edit up the 5,000 words that I had written on Sunday. So that took a little time. And then Tuesday night, I was a little sluggish. I had gone out with a friend to get some supper. And you know, then that kind of ran long a little bit, and by the time I got home and got settled, I got some things done, but not a ton. Finally, last night, you know, I was able to go ahead and really tie into the epilogue. So I think I got past the emotional part of the epilogue. I don't know until I actually read it, hopefully today, but I think I did, and I started getting into then the final little kind of wrap-up mystery type piece thing there at the end. So all in all, I'm close. The goal now, since I'm so late and so long on this book, the goal now is to get finished up this weekend so I can start editing this weekend. I got a couple of little other things that are going to intrude on that this weekend, so I'm going to be losing some time. But hopefully by Sunday morning, I'm going to be editing. That's the goal. Sunday morning, I'm editing. And then it's going to be a dead run because I've got to get the editing done in 2 weeks, which it usually takes me on a normal length book, 2 weeks. And this book is long. But I'll get the editing done and then turn around. I think I've got a pretty good start on some base pictures for the cover. In pretty good shape with the kids' costumes on the cover. Just turn around, get those done. Worst case scenario, I'm hoping to have all the books ordered by midpoint the last week of March, which is a little late because normally I send them out right at the beginning, on April 1st. I like to have them in the mail April 1st, and that may slide a couple of days. But I'll be close. And then I turn around and I start book 11. Somebody asked me this last week, so then do you get a little time off between books? Nope. Just turn around, start the next one. But I've been planning for this particular book ever since the end of the first 8. So 11, you know, is a big one because it's the third book into the second stanza. And the second stanza is surely some revelation is at hand. The second coming, surely the second coming is at hand. So that's books one. That is books 1 and 2 of the second set of 8, which 10 is the second book in the second set of 8. So the first book in the second set of 8 was Surely Some Revelation Is at Hand. Then the second book is Surely the Second Coming Is at Hand. And then the third book, which is book 11 in the series, is The Second Coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. So, you know, I've been kind of planning for that point really ever since the books formed up and the idea formed up and I started mapping it out. There's, you know, there are things, there is a thing that happens in this book that becomes crucially important for the next, for this set of 8 books, and then it affects what's coming in. So, you know, I kind of know where I am, and I'm set up for it, so I think it'll be fine just to hop straight into that, and hopefully not go quite as long as book 10 is going. Because it's, these books are supposed to come in at 140, around 140, 150, and book, it's already climbing towards 174, which is almost, what, 30,000, 25,000 more, 35,000 more than it should be, which there's just no space in the schedule for that. At 10,000 words a week, I have 16 weeks in the schedule to write when it's all said and done. So that means these books need to come in no longer than 160,000 words, and I've got a whole full other week. Anyways, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. God is faithful, step at a time. And that's what I've been telling myself this week. You know, I didn't really get too terribly concerned and anxious about it. Even last night, as I was sitting down, I hadn't hit the emotional spot yet. I didn't quite have it. But, you know, this feeling, I've done this enough times now, that this feeling was just put your fingers in motion, start writing words, you'll figure it out. It'll come. You just have to put your fingers in motion. And so, you know, last night, of course, was fast night. And so I was tired anyways, but I got through my finances as quickly as I could because that's normal Wednesday stuff. And then I just got down and started writing and it just started coming together. It still needs a little tweaking, but I think it's there. I don't know for sure yet, but I think it's there because I have to reread it and see where we at. And I'll do a little bit of tweaking on it, but I think the core of it is there, and it's on the page, which is good. So anyways, that process, that environment is really what I decided I was going to talk about today, but I was going to talk about it from the perspective of an article that I came across. And as I was reading this article, I was just thinking, oh, this is so sad. Because, at least from my perspective, I know exactly what is going on here. And I know absolutely that the solutions that the reporter poses in this article are not going to work. And if nothing changes, well, that's not true. Some of the things are pretty good, and they will probably work. But if nothing changes in the life of this individual, I just don't see how there's any real capacity to get free. Because the name of this article was The Age of Anxiety. And the author of the article begins by talking about her. I'm assuming this is a her because the name is Talia. Begins by talking about her experience. Well, she first of all begins with a really interesting passage, a really interesting second paragraph. The first line is, America seems to be in the midst of a full-blown panic attack. America isn't. Certain people in America are. But there are plenty of people in America, I would hope, who are like me, who are not in the midst of a full-blown panic attack. And there's a reason that we're not. But we'll get to that in a little bit. So she had some really nice imagery right here at the beginning. She said, authors have many images to describe distorted mental states. But that of a glass enclosure, which warps vision and sound, is among the most common. Now, keep in mind that glass enclosure, because that's really important. In his searing essay on the loss of his daughter, Alexander Hemon uses the metaphor of an aquarium to describe the detached sensations caused by profound grief. Sylvia Plath's titular bell jar is her symbol for the airless perceptions of suicidal depression. The intercession of glass between human sight and the world is present, even in the New Testament, when in 1 Corinthians we are told that earthly life is seen through a glass darkly. In a heavenly future, no glazer's hand will intercede before the face of God. Now, that's a beautiful phrase. In a heavenly future, no glazer's hand will intercede before the face of God. So she goes on. She goes on to talk about anxiety, and it can have this distorted, glassy quality as well. And she talks about when she had her first panic attack when she was in Russia in 2010. And she said, the entire world shrank to the size of my frantically pulsing aorta. Said she went to the Russian she got the Russian EMTs. They pronounced that the EKG had shown her to be in perfect condition. They gave her a concoction of herbs to drink. At dawn, she said, I nodded into an uneasy sleep. They didn't find anything. But she said even when she came back from New Jersey, you know, she was hobbled by fear. Small being hobbled by fear. The universe eaten alive by dread. And she talks about how that according to studies by the National Institute of Mental Health, nearly 20% of Americans experience an anxiety disorder in a given year. Over 30% experience an anxiety disorder over the course of their lifetimes. And the rate is rising. The American Psychiatric Association, in a May study drawing from a survey of 1,000 adults, diagnosed a statistically significant increase in national anxiety since 2017. So she goes on to say, okay, so why does the present moment evoke such an efflorescence of nerves? She says, it's tempting to point the finger at Donald Trump, but he is the preeminent symptom of our age of anxiety, not its principal cause. Well, okay. So there are obviously people who are worried about Donald Trump. So she says that historical forces are driving the country to fear as never before. You know, we used to have the boundless optimism of a corn-fed post-war empire, cheerfully jingoistic and fat in the coffers. You know, the nation has awoken to its 21st century hangover, a long jittery ride of past militant triumphism and economic overconfidence into endless war and endless uncertainty, okay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So she points to the fact that debt, decreasing ownership, lower employment rates are tangible stressors among millennials. She said the Geriatric Mental Health Foundation notes that common fears about aging can lead to anxiety, fear of falling, of isolation, of dependence, of degeneration. And for adults in the Middle Ages, the stresses of financially supported grown children while also caring for aging parents can lead to anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. She says this jittery mood has given rise to what Rebecca Jennings at Vox has dubbed anxiety consumerism. All kinds of products out there now that can help you with anxiety, fidget spinners, essential oil sprays, you know, an explosion of products featuring CBD. A non-psychotropic marijuana-derived products whose proponents say induces calm, et cetera, et cetera. Quoted in the New York Times, a CBD startup founder compared its effects of the compound to a warm bath, melting the tension away, et cetera, et cetera. So, but she points to other things as well. She says, in recent years, our politics has become a politics of primal fear. And of course, she goes after Fox News. None of the other news organizations. She goes after Fox News for, you know, drumming up this thing that a human wave is washing up at our southern border in incomprehensible numbers, bringing disease and murder in its wake, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, she spends paragraphs on this, how, you know, the thing about the wall and blah, 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 blah. She goes on to say anxiety, and to me, it's like paragraphs of stuff where it's like, okay, I think you could have mentioned this and then moved on, but she wanted to, like, talk about the wall. So that's fine. You know, it's not hard to tell a person's politics anymore when you read news. So she goes on to say that anxiety disorder tends to fixate on specific objects, a shadow in a room, a loud noise in the street, the memory of a strained social interaction, the prospect of going outside. She says the migrant caravan was undoubtedly such a fixation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She said some of the entirely justified fear, and one thing we should note on these fixations of specific objects, a shadow in the room. Is the shadow inherently dangerous? No. A loud noise in the street, is the loud noise always dangerous? No. A memory of a strained social interaction, you know, that happened in the past. You can't change it. The prospect of going outside, the perception of what is outside, is that the reflection of reality? No. She says, you know, some of it is entirely justified fear of what is fearsome, struggle, deprivation, dying. In the APA study, the people of color reported significantly higher anxieties in an environment of rising strident racism. Rising strident racism. Or maybe it's a perception of rising strident racism. You know, the safety net, anxiety over where or not you're going to be laid off, etc., etc. So she says, any attempt to rescue America from its deep-worn rut of fear must involve an attempt to address the conditions that gave rise to the terror. Okay, she said, 8 years after my initial diagnosis with a panic disorder, I've made a kind of fitful process toward peace, managing my condition more or less with medications and cognitive behavioral therapy. Lately, I have been working on mindfulness. This is good. The separation of troubled thoughts from self, the gathering of breath, the practicing of exercises meant to induce tranquility. It's slow, difficult work, shot through with setbacks, like a recent evening in which I became so convinced that I would choke on a plate of dumplings that I threw them violently away from me, spilling ponzu sauce all over the floor. I wasn't killed by dumplings, and I quickly cleaned up the dark, sticky patch on my floor. I took a few deep breaths and resolved to continue the work of trying to fix my broken psyche piece by piece, causes uncovered, wounds dressed, breathing ragged, then rhythmic. She says that emerging from this ludicrous and fearful dream of this era will be a long and painful process. That doing so won't be merely a matter of finding the right drug to slow the nation's pulse. It's clear that comforting a troubled populace involves more than soothing words or, still worse, provocative, terror-fueled solutions to falsified, magnified problems. Any attempt to rescue America from its deep-worn rut of fear must involve an attempt to address the conditions that give rise to that terror. The slow, unglamorous work of unknotting ourselves from fear is something we all have to work towards through the electoral politics, of course, and involved in the great civic nation. Now, okay, there's nothing wrong with trying to work towards a better future in America. There's nothing wrong with that, to try to redress some of the things that need to be addressed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is, if you're waiting for politics to clean up all the things that you see as things that have to be addressed in America, you are never going to get over your anxiety. Because anytime we clean up one thing, you're going to find something else. As example, university campuses have, I mean, if any place in America, university campuses are trying to clean up environments to make places that are fair and equitable, you look up at the Ivy League college and their hiring practices and their sensitivity training and all of these are safe spaces and coloring books and all of these things that they've gone through to try to make an environment where students will not feel as anxious, where students will feel like they're okay. Has that made them havens for sociologically and psychologically balanced, strong individuals? No. No, it hasn't. It has created fragile individuals who have a perception of the world that is foundationally different than many people who would be looking in on it from the outside. I may have mentioned this before. I believe it was Brown University. I should have really checked my facts before I said anything about this. But there was one university where the students were staging a sit-in at the dean's office. And I believe, if I remember the story correctly, that they were demanding that they not have as much homework and schoolwork because they were spending all their time simply not trying to get murdered, trying not to get killed on campus. And it was just impossible for them to handle the type of load of studies that was being demanded of them. Okay, this is like an Ivy League college or somewhere, something comparable to it, where all of these it's not acquisitions. I just lost the word. Accommodations. All of these accommodations are being made to make sure people's feelings aren't hurt. And yet after we make all these accommodations, it does no good. Their anxiety just keeps going up to the point where they truly believe, and no one can tell me they're just claiming this, they truly believe that they are in danger of being killed at any moment on these colleges' campuses, that they are not safe, that there are raging hordes of people who are ready to peer out of nowhere and run them down and kill them. Because anxiety is not created by our circumstances. You know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, it's been a long time since I've read Gulag Archipelago, but Alexander Solzhenitsyn made note of the fact that the people who maintained the best mental attitudes seem to more often than not be Christians. Because there was something in the inner strength that was granted them through faith that allowed them to cope with their circumstances better. And for me, that and then just my own personal experience really comes down to an idea. And we all know this idea is true, but maybe we don't believe we have as much control over it as I think we do. And that is the idea that I've been sharing with my friends the last couple of weeks. Last week, I don't know. And I may have mentioned this last week as well. The weeks kind of blur together after a while. And that is that you have to know what movie you're starring in. Because the fact is, of each of us, we're in our own movies. I mean, what we actually experience in the moments as they rush by us, what we experience is not reality. It is our senses presenting what they perceive, and our brain building an internal model of the world that we then assign meaning to. And if you don't believe that our brain is actually building an internal model, there's some just really easy things. You would think, for instance, if your eyes dart to the side, that you would be able to move your eyes faster than the 60 frames of second or so what our eyes are. And yet we never see things blurred. And why is that? It's because the brain is compensating. We have blind spots in our eyes where the optic nerve goes over the retina. There are actual blind spots where we cannot see in that spot. And yet when we look out, we don't see those blind spots. I had a friend once tell me that her ophthalmologist was telling her about an older man who had lost the peripheral vision on his left side. He just completely lost it. He didn't know he had completely lost it because his brain was manufacturing it over there. So he thought he still had it. And she told him, you know, she did some tests and she told him, she said, well, you can still drive. But when you drive, you have to turn your head and look before you make any kind of a lane change, before you assume anything but about what is to your left. I think it was his left. Because if you don't, you won't see it. Because the brain is going to fill that in. It's a marvelous thing. Well, just like the brain fills in all. The other example is that we only have sharp focus in a very small spot right ahead of us, right what we're looking at. You know, everything focuses on that spot in the retina in the back, and that's where we have the density that can give us the sharp focus. The rest of it is really all kind of just blurry and much more blocky and that sort of thing. And yet, when we look out, we have a perception that everything is in focus. Because the brain is doing all those things. And just like the brain is doing all those things, the brain is calculating constantly what we should be experiencing in this world that it has built. So it is deciding, should we be happy? Should we be anxious? Should we be sad? Should we be angry? Should I be content? Should I? And that's the movie you're starring in. The processes that the brain is going through, that's the movie you're starring in. Now, the real kicker in all of this, and one of the reasons I'm going to be so happy to get to heaven, is the kicker in all of this is that we have a flesh within us, and you can describe it any way you want to. Our demons, you know, the ego, the whatever. There's a whole bunch of ways that we describe this. The devil on your shoulder, you know, whatever. And those things are constantly, that thing is constantly whispering to us and lying to us. Pure and simple, lying all day long, lying to us about what's coming, what we're experiencing. What did that person mean when they said that? And if we listen to those lies, it changes our perception of what movie we're starring in. And we end up, it doesn't matter what our circumstances are, if you listen to it enough and you start drifting that direction, it will amplify. And it will just keep being louder, louder, louder until you can end up with students who are in one of the most privileged environments in America on a university campus where everything is devoted to their well-being and they truly believe that they're starring in some sort of a horror flick, serial killer murder flick, where if they just walk across campus, someone's going to jump out and kill them. And they are convinced of that. It is their movie. It is their reality. And so the only solution I know to that type of thing is you've got to get that voice quieted down. And people can do this on their own without any religious thought or faith involved. Mindfulness is a good way to do this, to slow this voice down. Mindfulness. And the mindfulness is nothing more than when you start feeling those negative emotions, just start saying, okay, I'm really concerned at the moment. You know, I'm really anxious at the moment. I'm really angry at the moment. Should I really be this angry? Should I be this anxious? What is it truly that I'm anxious and angry about? Because if you can just step back and figure that out, if you figure out what the lie is you're being told, then you can say, is that true? And it's amazing how fast it will go. It's like me working on this book this week and realizing that I was long, and I hate being late on stuff. I just hate it. Realizing that I was long, and I mean, I was long, long, long. And even after I'd put in 15,000 words and I did everything I could, I was long. But see, I have based my life on certain core foundational beliefs, and it doesn't matter if I'm long. I believe that I am in a movie. I am in an adventure with Him who loves me, with Him whom my soul loves. And I believe that this is just a breath. This is just a whisper, this life. And I try in my life to focus on the things that will make a difference in 50,000 years. Kindness, generosity, discipline, gentleness, love, peace, joy. And I believe that He is with me and He will help me. Because all the time the flesh was trying to tell me, you don't have the emotional part yet. You don't have the emotional part. You're not going to land this book. This book isn't going to have the same type of emotional punch that the other's book has. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I would just tell myself, you know what? 9 books I've done now. And I've been in this position before where I didn't know how I was going to land it. But as I put my fingers in motion, magic happened. Because He was with me. And see, if you have that concept of the fact that He is with you, and the concept that the anxiety within you is just lying about something, that's a powerful, powerful combination. Does it mean that you won't have thoughts skittering through your head trying to make you anxious? Does it mean, like right now, I'm supposed to already be done with this podcast. And it's like, you're not going to get enough writing done. You're not going to get enough writing. But, there are things that are important for 50,000 years. If you recognize the lies within you, and then you can turn yourself around and stabilize yourself on the fact that God is with me, He's going to give me help. He's going to whisper to me and help me to know the path before me. I'm going to take it one more time, and He is going to be faithful because He loves me. And He is the one whom my soul loves. And if I have to endure things in this life, I'll endure them. Because this is just a shadow of what's coming. And the sad thing about this author of this article is she is trying to make progress, but she's missing that critical piece. She probably has a religious background. People don't just quote. They don't just quote from Corinthians without some kind of background, and this idea of this glass enclosure, if she's constantly believing that enclosure is created by external forces and there's no way for her to break through it, she's going to feel trapped. But if she ever comes to this realization, as she appears to be from the mindfulness, but if she ever gets through this process and realizes that her perceptions are in large part colored by the glazier, by the dark glass that's in front of her, and that dark glass is in fact being created by her flesh that she has dominion over because it's her flesh and she doesn't have to listen to those lies, then there's a pathway out, and it has nothing to do with what's going on around her. Nothing to do. You know, and people could look at my life and say, well, you're just very privileged and this, that, and the other. You know, but the fact is, last couple of weeks, it's been pretty exciting. In the last couple of weeks, I've had some times when I've had to put on a little drummer boy. You know, the arrangement by King and Country. Big percussion arrangement. and I have listened and I have remembered, shall I play for him? I played my best for him. And then he smiled at me. I remembered that. Bring that to memory, that all I've got here is I'm going to play my best for him. And see, all that stuff on the outside, then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because once you quiet the flesh down within you, once you turn your focus towards him, your circumstances are not the thing that will govern your life. It is your understanding that this life is but a breath and a whisper. It is insubstantial. And him whom my soul loves is waiting for me whenever this life comes to an end. And it's gonna be good. So I'll just do everything I can for him now so I can look back and say, I played my best for him. This is Phil Ferrand. I have made it to the church. Have a great weekend.